Okay, welcome back. We continue our voyage. We are now in the process of tefillah following Kriya Shema, and right before Shemona Esrei, there's a rather lengthy paragraph called Ezras. If you take a look at the end of the second sheet, you'll see the first three lines of this tefillah called Ezras Avisena Atu Mi'olam. This is the final the final paragraph preceding Shemona Esrei. And obviously, we understand that there needs to be some connection between this and the various things that are going on in the process of tefillah, which is the goal of what we're trying to accomplish here, to gain some clarity into what we're trying to accomplish. Chazal tell us that the tefillahs in general, the prayer in general, is there to replace what in the Beis HaMikdash was the Karban Tamid. Karban Tamid was the daily obligatory sacrifice. It was brought once in the morning and once in the afternoon. So therefore we understand that Shachris and Mincha are in the place of the Karban Tamid. Ma'ariv obviously has a different purpose. The question we're going to deal with both this week and next week, because I over-prepared, is the issue of when something is done in the place, in the stead of something else, there needs to be some common ground. You don't, and this is one of the main reasons why it doesn't say that in the place of the Karban Tamid you should chew bubble gum, because there's little common value between bubble gum and Karban Tamid. So obviously, if Chazal are telling us that since we no longer have the Beis HaMikdash, that in the place of the Beis HaMikdash, in the place of the Karban Tamid, we are to daven, well, whatever was accomplished, or to some degree, whatever was accomplished through the sacrificing of the Karban Tamid needs to take place in prayer. Otherwise, there's no reason for one to replace the other. There's got to be something similar in accomplishment. The Karban Tamid was brought was brought as a sacrifice of a lamb that was 1 year old, and it was completely and totally consumed by the altar, its meat, its bones, the gidim, its fats, except for the leather and the wool, which were given to the Kohen. But everything else was completely consumed by the altar. So where we're heading right now is to an understanding of how one replaces the other. And we're not going to get there today. But let's lay the groundwork. We've been discussing in the last 26 sessions the concept of creation being the result of an emanation, which is obvious material, coming from an emanation that comes from Hashem Yisbarach, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu allowed his infinite, what they call the infinite light, or a form of an emanation to come forth from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which allowed the world to come into being. Before creation, which is almost a contradiction in terms, because time is a creation as well. So how you have anything before creation is fabulous headache material. You think about what preceded time. But before creation, these emanations were part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. No different than you would find with the rays of the sun. Before these particular rays emanate outwards, they're contained in the sun. Once creation comes into being, once HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates the world, as a result, HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows these emanations to go forth from him and to create a world. That was the process of creation. And this process results in the unbelievable miracle, that which is completely unfamiliar to us as human beings, and that is something called creation. What does creation mean? Unlike to form something or to shape something or to alter something as human beings are able to do, creation literally means creating something out of nothing. In Hebrew, that's called yesh mi'ayin. It's a concept which is completely foreign to us because there's no way that a human being can do it. It's the famous story that I've shared with you so many times about the scientist who challenges God and says, you know, I don't think it's such a big deal that you created a human being. I can do it too. So God says, okay, let me see. So the scientist bends down and begins to gather some earth together. And God says, no, you want to make a human being? Go get your own earth. Don't use the earth I created. Then you're not creating. Then you're, once again, you're forming out of things that I created. You take outlines. Outlines right here on this table. The creation of yesh mi'ayin, the creation of something out of nothing, is something that only HaKadosh Baruch Hu can do. That's something which is clearly and totally only a godly ability. No human being has the ability of creating a yesh mi'ayin. I want to run an idea by you. This is a little bit of a, not a distraction, what is it called? A digression. But I thought it was really cool. Think about this for a moment. We say in davening that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is mechadesh b'chol yoyim tamid ma'aseh bereishis. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu renews every day, constantly, all of creation. From the vantage point of an average perspective, certainly from the vantage point of people who form things, that's one of the great distinctions. I can draw a beautiful picture, I can print up an outline, and I will stop thinking about it, and it continues to exist. I don't need to recreate it and reprint it every moment, right? Whereas we're saying here that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, for some reason, has to recreate it every moment. Well, you know, is there something wrong with the system? Why does he need to recreate the world moment by moment? So I saw an article written by Rabbi Yoel Kahn where he writes a very... I have to reread it another few times. But he writes a very intriguing argument. He says, if you take a ball and you throw the ball upward, you will notice that virtually every time the ball will come down again. Now, while the ball is going upward, it is defying the force of gravity. Right? Gravity forces things to come down, and this ball is going up. Nonetheless, nobody would say, if they were to scientifically analyze the ball, they would not say, well, right now, rather than matter being something that comes down, this matter has changed. It is really an upward-going form of matter. Right? That's not true. You wouldn't say that this has scientifically been altered so that it goes up. So what's the distinction? The distinction is that we have applied a force to the ball, a force which has the ability temporarily to go against the force of gravity. As long as that force is still upon the ball will continue to go upward. The moment that that force is removed from the ball, that force expires, then nature will take over and it will fall again. Right? This does not take a great physicist to figure out what this analysis, right? Nature, if you can say this, the natural state of things, in our experience, is non-existence. The proof is, there is no chronicled case in the last 5,000 years of anybody having created something. Therefore, what does that say to us? That says to us that true status quo of the world is non-creation. The proof is nobody's created anything. We form things into many different forms. But as far as creation goes, nobody's ever created anything. Now, therefore, in essence, the creation of something flies in the face of nature. It's anti-creation is an anti-natural force. And just like when one propels a ball, it requires that motion which defies nature. It can only go up as long as that motion is still on the ball. The creation of something from nothing, which is by far a much greater anti-natural force, requires recreation every moment, because without it, the world would just cease to exist. Anyway, that's something for you to think about while you're exercising or doing something else. I found it a very, very intriguing argument to necessitate the concept of why HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to recreate every moment, because it is such an anti-natural, creation is such an anti-natural phenomenon. Whatever the case is, creation is the creation of something out of nothing. That's the wonder of creation. Everything which we find in our experience has a higher source. Humor has a higher source too. Meaning, there is humor on high. What is God's sense of humor? In order to understand that, one of the great senses of humor is that he pairs together couples, one who likes it hot in the house and the other one who likes it cold. That's part of the Rabbeinu Shlomo's sense of humor. But let's analyze humor for a moment. Rabbi Karsh once did this when he was here for Shabbos at the Shalosh Shuddos. He did an analysis of why we find things funny. So he says you have a movie camera, and it's focusing on a person very briskly walking down the street, very gingerly walking with all the confidence in the world. And then it pans back, and you see about 50 feet ahead of him, there's a banana peel on the sidewalk. And it pans back to the person walking with this great confidence up and goes back to the banana peel. And the two are getting closer and closer, and it goes back and forth and back and forth. And then he's about 10 feet in front of the banana peel, and he falls into a manhole. That's open. Of course, everybody, there's a room full of people. Everybody laughed. And then he turns and says, "Why is that funny? The guy just fell into a manhole. Why are you laughing?" What's funny about it is that humor is the unexpected. It's a contrast of the expected and the unexpected. There's something about when somebody naturally expects something to take place and then all of a sudden it's defied by circumstances. We had, I don't know how many of you know, I'm sure he wouldn't mind my telling this story, Yitzi Steinhardt ate at our house on Simchas Torah. Yitzi is a big guy. He's well over 6 feet and a broad, he's a big, solid guy. He's sitting at the table directly across from me. And we had just opened up our fresh jars of our sharp pickles. And we put out with pickles and peppers and different things on the plate. And he's sitting across from me. All of a sudden I look up and Yitzi is beet red. And for a moment I thought he was choking. So I said to him, Yitzi, you okay? He's like, look at this. I said, are you choking? So he shakes his head, no. But I look at him again, and he's pointing to a habanero pepper on his plate. And he can barely be seen. What is that? Anyway, I completely lost it. I could not regain my composure. It took me 10 minutes. And Chani's looking at me like I'm completely crazy. She's, the poor guy is suffering across from you. And you're laughing. Like, what is funny about this? It just was the scene of this big guy who completely, it took him 10 minutes to get back to himself from tasting this habanero pepper. So there's an element of surprise, there's an element of the unexpected which brings about this humor. The schaik of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, humor on high, is when human beings who operate in a world which appears to be a world created something out of nothing, and the human being looks at that which everybody else perceives as being something and recognizes that without the Ribbono Shel Olam creating it moment by moment, it would cease to exist. So that in essence, the appearance of existence, which is independent of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is nothing more than an illusion. That in essence, everything which exists is moment by moment dependent upon the word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to sustain it, and therefore it's nothing more than an illusion. When a person recognizes that, what they're doing is taking the yesh and reversing it back into an ayin. The Ribbono Shel Olam created a world which is yesh me'ayin, which we look at and we say, this is real, this is something created from nothing. Comes the human being, and the human being is able to take the yesh, to take the something, and reverse it back into a nothing. Is able to elevate it back into the form where they say this doesn't exist if not for the moment by moment sustenance of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's funny. That is schoik to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That is the unexpected. It's a human being who's able to rise above their limitation and recognize that what they're looking at is not as they perceive it. That's where sense of humor comes from. It comes from the ability of a human being to rise above the limitations and recognize that we have the ability to reverse nature, to reverse creation. Creation is the creation of something out of nothing. The human being has the ability to take the something and return it back into a nothing, meaning to recognize that what they're looking at is not as it appears. So that's the schoik. The most powerful example of this in Jewish life was the bringing of a sacrifice on the altar. To take, if you wanted a paradigm, if you wanted to take an example of something which is migushim. Migushim means something which is so physical. And to take it and return it back to its true status, it was the taking of a beast, of an animal, and consuming it on the Mizbeach and allowing it to return to its source. Therefore, the Beis HaMikdash becomes the place of the greatest humor, of the greatest schoik, of the greatest joy in the world. Because it is the place of retransformation of the yesh to an ayin, of the something to a nothing. That was the joy of the Karban. Okay? Yeah.
So, and that's the root of Yitzchak's name.
True.
So, are we trying to say, is there a possibility that
who was the first sacrifice, by the way?
Right, yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like, it's all circular there.
Yeah. I hadn't thought of that. That's right. Yitzchak was the first sacrifice. The others say, by the way, the Apturov says that the reason he was called laughter was because of the exact reason that the angels laughed when they saw Yitzchak's nature. Yitzchak had this severe nature, Midas HaGvura, which was in direct contrast to his father's chesed. The Apturov says that the angels laughed. The example he gives, he says, why do you laugh on Purim when you see a man dressed in a woman's clothing, a woman dressed in man's clothing? He says, it's the surprise element. It's the complete unexpected. He said, that's why Yitzchak ended up being named Yitzchak, because it was funny that you had a person of such ultimate kindness having a son who has such an exact opposite nature. But the carbon element of it is the same thing. You're right. I believe that this this paradigm of the return of the recognition of the human being, that the physicality of the world is completely and totally dependent upon HaKadosh Baruch Hu to the degree where it has no independence, that the appearance is not what it is, was the cause of why in the Beis HaMikdash there were 10 daily miracles that took place. Chazal tells us that there was there was clear suspension of nature in the Beis HaMikdash. And the reason for this was very simple. The human being came along and declared and exposed godliness in the physical world. In response to that, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, if that's what you're doing, if you're exposing godliness, and in return, I will create a revelation of godliness in the world. So it was a direct result of the human being's acknowledgement of the sustenance of the physical world by Hashem, that in response, Hashem said, I will reveal myself to you in the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore, the moment Klal Yisrael stopped bringing the Karbonos, HaKadosh Baruch Hu destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. Because it had no purpose. The moment the Karbon Tumid stopped, the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed within a very short period of time. Because there was no, the purpose of the Beis HaMikdash, this place of ultimate joy, as the Psukim tell us, was a place of revelation. If the human being reveals, HaKadosh Baruch Hu reveals. The moment the human being stops revealing, there was no purpose to the Beis HaMikdash. HaKadosh Baruch Hu destroyed it. And I think that's why, on Tisha B'Av, it's forbidden to eat. Because our interaction with the physical world is supposed to be an extension of what took place in the Beis HaMikdash. And on the day that HaKadosh Baruch Hu saw that we stopped declaring the Almighty as being the ultimate truth in the physical world, it was on that very day that HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to us, this is not a successful day in man's interaction with the physical world. Stay away from it. It was due to the ultimate failure of the revelation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the physical that Hashem says to us, declare a day off from all physical things. This day was a failure of human beings being able to reveal. So man is called upon to step aside.
So the only purpose from the Beit HaMikdash is just for Korban, not something else.
But there were many side things, but it was certainly the primary purpose of the Beis HaMikdash, was to bring about that revelation due to man's revelation in the Karbanos, to bring about the revelation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Alright, let's go on to section 3. The first section 3. This was done in a very, very lofty place. I did my email on the plane on the way back to from Toronto. The email, the outline. Psukah de Zimra. The process, as we've been discussing in the last 26 sessions, the purpose of tefillah is the revelation of reality. It's a trip in reality. And that trip begins with Psukah de Zimra, which Zimra means to sing. Zimra also means to prune, to cut away. And the Mefarshim tell us that these are psukim of removal, of removing the false presentation of the world. And therefore we repeat these psukim again and again, and we repeat the concepts again and again to ingrain in our consciousness, to bring ourselves to a point of realistic vision as to what is real and what is facade. that reality is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and this world is a mere extension of His presence. That's the point of Pesukei DeZimra. From there we move into the brachas of the Shema. The brachas of the Shema are designed to call into into our consciousness the concept of that there are places where the Ribbono Shel Olam is more revealed. It's a step up in the process, in the processes of creation. Meaning, and again, we talked about this at length, that there are places where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is much more apparent. All of us have an image of the fact that the worlds in which the angels exist don't have the kinds of concealment that we have. And for that reason, the entire essence of the world of the angels is to sing Shira HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to sing praises to Hashem. And that's what we focus on in the Birchas Krishna, is that there is a place where there is much greater revelation. And therefore, due to that revelation, the angels live their essence of life, if you can use that term. It's not, you know, the angels don't live and die, but their essence of existence is a song to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, due to that revelation. But here's what's critical. By definition, every creation, be it the level of an inanimate object, an animal, things which grow, the human being, or the supernal beings, the angels, and we know that among the angels there are thousands of levels of existence among the angels themselves. Every creation is finite. Every creation is defined, it's limited. If you want to talk about the fact that the angels live or exist in a realm where godliness is so much more apparent, where it is so real, we must understand that to the degree that HaKadosh Baruch Hu reveals Himself to the angels, to that degree should we understand that they're looking at a very limited perception of God. It can't be otherwise, because God is infinite and they're finite. Which means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, true, it's far more revealed. They're not dealing with the concealments of our world. They're not dealing with the temptations and the desires and the crassness of our world. It's a much more lofty spiritual world. But it's clearly a limited world. Their relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is extremely limited. Okay, they're not tempted with what we're tempted. In fact, there's this great cosmic argument as to one's approach to Torah and mitzvot. There are those who approach Torah and mitzvot. I encourage you to go to, there is a website for the NCSY. I think it's on the OU site, or maybe it's its own independent site. And there's a link there for a film, and I think it's Mayor Waxman on the film.
Is it okay if these kids come and catch the last half of your class?
They're here already from Kenosha. Yeah.
Can they sit in? No? What?
I don't want to go.
Not a good idea? Huh?
All right.
I don't know, whatever you think. I'll let them in. What do you think? Yes, no? Maybe.
Huh? I think it's a mistake.
Okay.
Anyway, go to the NCSY. There's a link there where it says for advisors only. And there's a very funny clip of a guy doing kiruv. It happens to be entertaining. One of the things that rang a bell as I was watching it is that one of the approaches that's used, I mean, it's used especially in child rearing, but it's used even in many svarim. is that our service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is motivated by reward and punishment. Meaning that we serve to receive reward, and we avoid not to be punished. Service, which is oriented around reward, obviously is dependent upon the extent of that reward. It's very hard to motivate me these days with lollipops. It worked once upon a time. It worked for many, many years, actually. I moved. I matured, by the way, in that thing. It went from Wrigley's Spearmint to Juicy Fruit at the time, and finally to Big Red as I matured in my taste. But that's pretty much where that whole realm of rewards stopped, and then it went to Big Bucks. Most of you don't remember the operations, but...
Now it's habaneros.
That's right. Or Gribanus. Don't forget about the Gribanus. The greatest reward attainable to human beings is what Chazal tells us. Olam haba, the world to come, is tzadikim yoishvim, the righteous sit, v'nehenim iziv ha-shechina, and they bask in the rays of the Shechina. But as we've discussed in the past, the rays of the Shechina are just that. It's very, very limited. It's infinite. There's level after level. Chazal tell us that there's a Gan Eden Atacht, and that was where Adam HaRishon lived. So that for the place where we get reward is where he lived. His Gan Eden was a much higher Gan Eden. And they were banished from there. And beyond that, there's limitless places of reward. But they're all limited. There's only one being that's not limited in its access. And that is the human being in its physical existence. It's the only unlimited being. Why is it unlimited? Because due to the structure that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created in the fulfillment of Torah and mitzvahs, mitzvahs are Ratzon Hashem. Mitzvahs are the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Will is the essence of somebody. It stems from the essence of somebody. You ever sit down and have an argument with somebody about what's better? Sweets or things which are salty? It left to my choice, I would take a bag of potato chips over a chocolate bar. Hands down, there's no match. Just the sweets are not appealing. Now, if you sit down and have this argument with somebody, you'll argue yourself to oblivion. You'll never convince them of your position because it's not an intellectual exercise. It comes from one's essence. This is what I am. I like AB. I like it hot in the room. I like it cold in the room. You can argue with somebody for the day of the month. 68 is the perfect temperature. And you can show it to them statistically. I like it at 70. There's no arguing. It's not something which you can argue. It's something that comes from, yes, mitzvahs are connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu without any forms of process, without any limitations. It is only in this human form that we have the ability to connect on that level. So the purpose of the brachas of the Shema is to do a comparative study between ourselves and the supernal beings. What we're drawing a contrast in the brachas of Krishna is to say, here we have this image of the angels and their visions of clarity and their attainments in spirituality to the degree where their essence is to cry, Kadosh, 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 Hashem Tzvokais. Hashem is infinitely great and holy and removed. And nonetheless, in the fulfillment of a single mitzvah, a Jew attains a greater connection in that one moment than the entire existence of all the angels. That's the contrast we draw in the Birchas Krishma. Otherwise, there's really no purpose. If you analyze it from an objective point of view, there is no purpose to talking about the angels. We don't talk about them in the Shema. It's to draw our attention to what we can accomplish. It's to such a degree when the Mefarshim write that if a Jew were to come to this world and suffer through 70, 80, 90 years of misery to fulfill a single mitzvah, that it was worth the entire life for that one moment of connection. That's letter C, absolute godliness. In the second section, number three, we reach what's considered to be the climax of davening, and that's the words Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. And that is a statement that all of the transformation and everything HaKadosh Baruch Hu did to limit himself to bring about this concealment of this world, which is the concept of Elohim, he did for us. Hashem Elokeinu, and nonetheless we recognize Hashem Echad. Hashem Echad does not only mean there is one God. Hashem Echad means there is only God. There's a huge difference between those two statements. Hashem Echad, as the Baal Shem HaKadosh taught, as brought even from Ramchal and others, means everything due to the fact that it is completely and totally dependent upon the moment-by-moment sustenance of Hashem. Means that there is nothing but Hashem. And therefore, all of the distractions and all the desires and all the temptations and all of the likes and all of the loves and all the desires, everything is completely null and void when we come to the moment of clarity of the fact that it's Hashem Echad. Oftentimes we'll be in the middle of a really good dinner and the phone will ring and it'll be somebody important, and you know the food is just at that right temperature where it's just right now to be, you know, and the phone rings, it's an important call. He's, okay, put him on hold, I'll be with him in 2 minutes. You know that when you come back, it's just not going to be the same. You can microwave it, the microwave ruins it. It's not the same. And oftentimes it'll be an important call, something that you really want to take. And nonetheless, you're forced to choose between two things. Right? Two things that actually might be pleasant. Last week I was sitting in, Friday morning. I was eating. And I heard the baby gagging in the other room. It sounded like he was choking. Now, there's few things in the world that are more offensive than soggy cereal. That'd be one of the most offensive things in the world. And nonetheless, I noticed that I didn't say to myself, just another 2 spoons, the baby will wait. Baruch Hashem, I got there just in time to get whatever it was in his throat out, and it came along with lots of other stuff. It's my group. What happened? Yeah, I like the cereal. But there's no comparison between the baby and the cereal. At that moment, did I not like cereal? Of course I liked the cereal. But it didn't even enter the picture of likes and dislikes at that moment. And it wasn't a relevant thing. What happens in the process of Kriya Shema, it's not that everything else is liked or disliked. It's insignificant. It has no import. It's just not relevant. The result of Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, is V'ahavta es Hashem Elokecha, that one, just by force, by relevance, by import, yearns for Hashem. That's the result of the recognition that there is nothing but Hashem. What it says is that by comparison, there's nothing left which is of enough value at this moment to occupy my desires. and one is left with V'ahavta Hashem Elokecha. But that leaves a person with a tremendous yearning, a thirst, if you will, a thirst of love. I want to digress for a second because I think that this is really what was the first pasuk in yesterday's Torah reading. If you take a look at section 4. The opening pasuk is Vayomer Hashem el Avram. Hashem says to Avram, Lech lecha me'artzecha, go forth from your land, O mi'malad techom v'beis avicha, el ha'aretz asher rek. Hashem says, go forth from your land to the land which I will show you. Aretz is a synonym. Earthiness, gashmius, physicality. Hashem is saying to Avram, Avram, you and I are going on a journey together. In essence, it is the journey, the Zohar says, excuse me, Avram donishmasa. Avram is the soul. Hashem is saying to the soul, the journey of davening is going from the Jew before davening to the Jew after davening. It's the Jew who views the Aretz, who views the world as a reality. El Ha'aretz Asher Rekah, to I'm going to show you a new world. I'm going to show you a completely different world perspective of the physicality of the world. You're going to go from a world which presents itself to you as being completely independent to a world which you will recognize is nothing more than Ha'aretz Asher Areka. It is a world that I show you. Remember, we were talking about this the first time, came up with the analogy of the hologram. It's a projection. It's a projection from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's Ha'aretz Asher Areka. You're going to see it as a earthiness which I am showing to you. It's a completely different definition of the gashmius of the world. And to that degree, I think that this explains, well, this is really a takeoff on something that I heard on a tape from my father. The Medrash says on yesterday's parsha that there are two lech lechas. Lech lecha of yesterday, go forth from your land to another land, and the lech lecha of the Akedah. Go take your son and slaughter him. And the Medrash says, which of these two is greater? Which of these two is a greater test? Move from Ur Kasdim to Israel, or kill your only child? And look at the Medrash, and it seems to be almost a ridiculous question. How could we possibly ask which of these two is a greater test? And the answer is in what we've been discussing now. We're seeing it as such a ridiculous question because to us, you can't compare moving from one place to another to the taking of a life. But when a person is living in the perspective, when they're living in the height of that moment of experiencing HaKadosh Baruch Hu as being the only reality, from that vantage point, from that far more mature vantage point, the two are equal tests. It's very hard for us to look at it, although every one of us can relate to it very simply. Because when we look at our own temptations, when we look at our own set of values, and then we bump into somebody who has never been exposed or experienced Yiddishkeit, and they talk to us, really? You don't turn on any lights? Or you don't drive anywhere on Shabbos? Or you take whatever example you want. Really, you don't eat shellfish? Like, to them, it's this, you know, this unbelievable, impossible thing to do. Unimaginable. You didn't watch the World Series game on Yom Kippur. It's just, you know, whatever it is that for one person is an absolute must. And we'll look at them and, you know, how can you compare that to Shabbos? How can you compare it to Yom Kippur? Or whatever it might be. It doesn't hold, at some point it doesn't even hold any standing to us. There is a point at which Avram Avinu's, the level of test was no different in one from the other. due to the maturity. And it wasn't asking, obviously, from our perspective, or even from the perspective that Avram was at when Hashem gave him the first test. Obviously, at that moment, he didn't give him the test of taking his son, because that was a test he could not have withstood. But after the test, and each one of us has tests at every level that we're at. Rabbanu Shalom tests each one of us differently in different stages of our life, based upon our understanding, based upon our maturity. And the test of today is very different from the test of 5 years ago. One of the things that I was thinking about last week is, which is a more difficult test? Taking on Kashrus and Shabbos and Taras and Mishpacha, or davening Shmon Esrei? It's almost as ridiculous of a question as a Medrash. But I think clearly davening Shmon Esrei is a much greater test. Because I know many people who have taken on Kashrus and Shabbos and Taras and Mishpacha. And I don't know anybody who can daven Shmon Esrei without distraction. But again, asking the question is, which is more difficult? You know, how could you compare? Far more difficult to daven Shmon Esrei properly. Let's just do one more section here. Section 5. So we're left with the thirst. So the Shema continues and says, "V'hayu hadvarim ha'ela asher anochi mitzavcha hayem al levavecha." These matters which I command you today should be upon your heart. The Torah uses a term which is anochi. Anochi is I. Mitzavcha means command you, but mitzavcha more importantly means connect to you. A Jew is left with this ultimate yearning and desire to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem says to me, I've given it to you. I've given you 613 methods of connection. And through those methods, there is the unbelievable opportunity for finite man to connect with infinite God. Anoichi mitzavcha. You want to quench your thirst? You can quench your thirst. You know how? Perform a mitzvah. That's the ability of the human being to be able to connect with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It is the most awesome opportunity left to a being of flesh and blood. The Pasuk says, we read it Shabbos morning, P'kudei Hashem Yisharim Misam Chelev. The mitzvahs Hashem are Yashar. Yashar means straight. They cause the heart to rejoice. The Baal Tanya interprets this pasuk and says, Yosher is like an interstate. It's a straight, huge, open road. Pikudei Hashem Yisharim. You know what a mitzvah is? A mitzvah is a huge, open interstate which allows the human being to connect with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's not called an interstate, it's called an interworld. It allows the human being in their physical state to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's the ultimate great question of Stephen Wright. Why are there interstates in Hawaii? That's what mitzvahs are. P'kudei Hashem Yisharim, they are Yashar, they're straight to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Misam Chalev, they cause us to rejoice. And we have to remember, the Pasuk adds one word, Hayayim. Today. Today means Olam Hab is a nice thing. Gan Eden's a beautiful place. But only today, when we are in our physical confines, the physical confines of our physical bodies with all of our aches and pains, is the only time that we have the opportunity to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Once we're in Gan Eden, it's a fun place. It's a great amusement park. But it doesn't give us the ability to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It is only Hayyim. It is only now in our physical being that we have the opportunity to connect. So in many ways, although it's clear that this world is a preparatory world to the world to come, in many ways, this world is where the action is. Because it's only here that we have the opportunity to connect with absolute godliness. It's only in physical form that we have the opportunity to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We'll take it up from here next week.